Because of the number of spectators, we're going to take a 10-minute recess. Council, in our first case on the 10 o'clock docket, may set up. Good morning again. We have council are ready to proceed in the General Steel case. Have you received our written instructions, and do you have any questions? For our spectators who may not have been here at 9, if any of you has a cell phone or pager, would you please turn it off so that the attorneys are not interrupted during their argument? Have council for our second case checked in?
Yes, Your Honor.
On that basis, we are ready for arguments in General Steel versus Better Business Bureau. Appellant, you needn't negotiate if you want to reserve time. If there's any left when you sit down, it's still yours.
May it please the court, I'm Steve Zansberg, State Bar Number 26634. On behalf of the defendants and appellants, the Denver Boulder Better Business Bureau, Gene Herman, and Matt Felling. Ms. Herman is present in the courtroom today, and with me at council table is Tom Kelly, my co-counsel in this appeal. Your Honors, over the course of 4 years of litigating this matter below, the defendants incurred over $1 million in fees and expenses. And then just 6 weeks before a 14-day jury trial was set to begin, the plaintiff, General Steel, moved to voluntarily dismiss all of its remaining claims, and it sought, as a condition upon its voluntary dismissal, first, that the dismissal be without prejudice, and second, that each party bear its own costs and attorney's fees. The defendants opposed General Steel's motion and asked the district court to impose as a condition that the dismissal be with either with prejudice or that the plaintiff be ordered to pay the defendants their costs and reasonable fees for work that would not be of use in the federal court action.
Well, let me ask for clarification. Did you ask for all of the fees, or did you acknowledge to the trial court that only some of those fees should be awarded? Because as I read it, it was essentially an all or nothing position.
We asked for all fees to which we would be legally entitled. Obviously, we couldn't ask for fees that we would not be entitled to. We cited the case law in our motion, the Powers case, which states that only fees recoverable are for those that are not transferable, not useful in the federal court. Your Honor's correct that we didn't specifically say, as I just said, that we're seeking fees only for work that is not useful in the ongoing litigation or to in defense of the continuing claims that are going to be litigated. But that is the only fees to which we're entitled to under the law.
Did you ask for a hearing so that you could prove what fees were and were not transferable?
General Steel, in its motion, asked for a hearing, and we set forth in our opposition several categories of work which I'll get to.
Okay.
Which clearly were not useful, could not be useful in the federal court action. We didn't go through the process of tendering the billing statements and making the evidentiary showing under the case law. It was pretty clear we assumed that that would occur after a grant of the motion or a grant of the condition. In granting General Steel's motion and imposing both of the conditions it had sought, the district court committed an abuse of discretion. An abuse of discretion occurs either when the district court misapplies the law or when there is a lack of any competent evidentiary support for its findings. Your Honors, the sum total of the grounds for the district court's order denying any award of attorney's fees and costs for the defendants is located at page 9753 of the record in volume 25, which I've reproduced here. My concern is that this may not be as readable as I'd hoped.
It's also in your attached to your notice of appeal.
Excuse me?
It's also attached to the notice of appeal.
That's correct. If Your Honors would like, I'd with leave of the court, I could present a copy of the entire order appealed from?
We have copies.
You all have it in front of you. Thank you. Your Honor, what the court, on page 5 of its order, which was tendered by General Steele, the district court made the following findings with respect to why no attorney fees and costs incurred in defense of this action below would not be useful in the federal court action. It says, there appears to be little question that the work product generated in this action will remain useful in the federal court action and can be easily transferred thereto. Notably, lacking from that finding is the word all. The district court did not find that all of the work product generated in this action will remain useful in the federal court action. In the case law we've cited in our briefs, notably the American Water Development Inc. case and the FSDW case, hold that when a plaintiff voluntarily dismisses without prejudice, the defendant is entitled to recover its attorney's fees and costs for all work expended that will not be useful in future litigation between the same parties. Accordingly, the district court misapplied the law in not finding that all of the work product in question would be useful in the federal court action, but in failing to impose as a condition of General Steele's voluntary dismissal that it be required to pay that portion of the defendant's fees and costs for work that will not be useful in the federal court action. Now, in the defendant's opposition to General Steele's motion, the defendants did demonstrate that while much of the work product generated below will be useful in the federal court action, much of it will not. Suffice it to say that there was more than a little question on that issue. Under Colorado law, the district court was obliged to set a hearing, as Your Honor noted, and as General Steele had requested that it do, in which the defendants could, through testimony of their attorneys and detailed review of the billing records over the 4-year litigation history and use of expert witnesses, establish the precise amount of the fees and costs that will not be useful in the federal court action. For General Steele to dispense with such a hearing, to have its proposed conditions adopted, it was required to demonstrate that 100% of the work product generated by the defendants below, in fact, would be useful in the federal court action, a showing it did not make, a finding that was not made, and a showing that, frankly, could not practically be made in a case of this complexity that had progressed to the point that it had progressed at the time of the dismissal.
What case or cases are you relying on to say that was General Steele's burden?
The cases that state, I believe, Powers and American Water, that a proponent of conditions to dismissal bears the burden of having the court adopt those conditions. The condition, although the defendants opposed the conditions, General Steele concedes that the district court adopted its own proposed conditions over the objection of the defendants. In any case, the defendants did point out numerous areas, tasks that would not be useful. As our reply brief in this court points out, citing some federal law and Powers and American Water, and I believe Haystack and Tillery all look at federal authorities for Rule 41A2, which is the exact same wording. There are certain tasks performed in one forum that inevitably cannot be transferred to another forum, state, federal in this case, such as numerous procedural scheduling orders or even the briefing on this very motion. The Rule 41A motion is clearly work that cannot be transferred to the federal court. There was also extensive attorney time devoted to briefing successful motions to dismiss General Steele's claims for negligence, gross negligence, conspiracy, breach of fiduciary duty, all claims that are not being litigated in the federal court action. There was also extensive attorney time devoted to briefing on the admissibility of the Phase 1 order entered by Judge.
Sorry to interrupt, but I just have a question. Whose burden is it to show the work is not useful, will not be useful?
Ultimately, at the hearing that we are entitled to, it is our burden to show that work will not be useful.
And what burden do you have before that hearing? In other words, in your pleadings, to point out to the judge that there is work that will not be useful.
I think we have a burden to, as we did at pages 8016 and 8025 through 26, provide a detailed recitation, perhaps not of all, not exhaustive, but to make clear to the district court that there is a significant body of work, attorney time and other expenses and costs that were expended that are not useful.
So you pointed out, you think the burden has been satisfied, you pointed out at least in pleadings to the court that there is work, there's a question of fact here that needs resolved.
Absolutely. And so this statement, there appears to be little question. It is not supported. There was a huge question. We pointed to 32 lay witness depositions that are not admissible in federal court.
And that was in the opposition?
Yes, so pages 8025-26 and 8016.
Well, I guess I'm concerned, to follow up my colleague's question, that the argument on 8025 and 26 is so cursory. I mean, you say, quote, indeed, the 32 depositions taken in this case are essentially meaningless since they do not bind the numerous additional parties named in the federal court action, period, close quote. I mean, there's no authority cited for that proposition. There's no analysis of, you know, the federal standards of admissibility of deposition. So I guess I'm concerned that you can't say that little and still preserve the issue and get it.
Again, Your Honor, I think we begin with a presumption that in a case of this complexity and detail, it is practically inconceivable that 100% of the work devoted over the course of time would be actually useful. In addition to the 32 depositions, we also noted that six expert witness reports and their depositions would not be admissible because they relate to different claims than those asserted and different scope of liability.
Well, did you mention the experts any place other than at 8412, which is what General Steele calls the supplemental motion? That may or may not be a fair characterization.
Yes, we did at, I believe, at page 825-6, I'm sorry, 8026, we stated the parties will need to resubmit expert reports that address issues of civil rights and RICO claims and redepose expert witnesses. That's at page 8026 in our opposition brief. We pointed out at page 8018 that discovering this case, including 32 lay witness depositions, thousands of pages of expert reports, and six depositions of expert witnesses, ellipses, will be meaningless in the federal court action.
So is it your position that you satisfy the burden at a hearing? And a hearing is
yes,
always done in these cases, or you satisfy your burden through the pleadings?
We satisfy the need to conduct a full evidentiary hearing, as is approved of in the American Water Development case, where after granting a dismissal without prejudice, the court later set an evidentiary hearing that went on for days, involving expert testimony and testimony of the attorneys to allocate the work between that which is useful and that which is not, resulting in a $2.7 million award of fees in that case. That was a process that was approved by this court in the Haystack case on remand to have a detailed evidentiary hearing to determine the exact amount of fees of work that cannot be used. I'd like to reserve.
Mr. Zinsberg, could you shortcut the hearing and save the days of work you're talking about by making conditions in the order that the dismissal's condition and all these depositions being used in the federal case, at least General Steele stipulating to the admission of these depositions and extra reports in the federal case? And is there some way the court can abbreviate this to accommodate and save judicial resources?
Well, General Steele did stipulate to admissibility of all discovery in the federal court case. It also stipulated to be bound by all dispositive rulings that it entered below, which it has since reneged upon, as pointed out in our briefs. The fact that General Steele stipulates the admissibility of the depositions does not render them admissible in the federal court action. There are 35 other defendants there who were not present at any of those depositions, were not apprised of those depositions, did not have a party who could advocate with the motivation that they have.
And so, asked Judge Ebell to rule on that?
We are asking Judge Ebell, not on the admissibility of the depositions, no. The other defendants, they haven't yet been tendered. The
or have you asked the other defendants if they would admit these depositions? I mean, why would they object to the admission of depositions taken of General Steele?
Because they weren't present and didn't have any. For instance, the witnesses that from the Better Business Bureau were asked no questions by defense counsel. Counsel for the other parties in those in the federal court action may well have asked questions. So for those depositions to come in as part of a summary judgment motion, for instance, could well be objected to by the other defendants. It is within their rights to do so. There hasn't been any stipulation. At the time this order was entered, it was clear that those 32 depositions were inadmissible. If I may, I have 1 minute I'd like to reserve for rebuttal.
May it please the court. My name is Dan Scheid, and I represent General Steele Corporation. There's no dispute, obviously, that this is a matter that was committed to the trial court's discretion. And I know this court is very familiar with what that standard means. Quite simply, this is a matter in which the trial court is given broad latitude to make the call based upon the actual record that is presented to her at the time of the motion and the briefing. The court's decision can only be overturned if there was an erroneous application of the law, which I'll speak to in a few moments. There clearly was not. Her findings and conclusion were manifestly against the weight of the evidence to compel a contrary result. And if there was a lack of competent evidence, meaning it was so devoid of evidentiary support that it can only be explained by an arbitrary or capricious exercise of authority. We respectfully submit that there is no rational argument that can be submitted that this court failed in any of those regards in issuing her order. There's no question that the court applied the correct legal standards. She set forth in detail in the first 3.5 pages of the order the legal standards that apply to this motion. She set forth the legal standards for granting a motion to dismiss without prejudice, for granting terms and conditions requested by the plaintiff, and for addressing any request that the defendant might make for reimbursement of costs and legal fees. Those standards
Counsel, sorry to interrupt, but in looking at the order, you agree that that's exactly what the order says?
No, there's much more to the order than that.
But as far as the quote, there appears to be little question that the work product generated. What amount of work product does that refer to?
I would
submit it doesn't say all, it doesn't say some, it just says work product will remain useful. I don't see how that refers to what quantity of work product.
Well, it says the work product generated in this action. That, I would submit, was intended to mean the sum total.
Well, there was some. I think all parties would agree there was some work product generated remain useful. I don't think BBB is disputing that, but I don't see how that quantifies what amount of the work product.
That particular line does not.
Is there another area in the order that does?
Well, I think generally if you take the entire context of the order and the fact that there had been an action in state court and that it was essentially moving over to federal court and that the action in state court was in essence a subset of the action that was moving to federal court, I think the intent of the order and certainly the evidence that was presented to the court was that body of work, that work product in state court, could easily be transferred to federal court and all of it could be used.
Well, what evidence are we referring to? There was no hearing.
There was no hearing, but we submitted briefs, and the trial court obviously was in a position where she had been presiding over the case for several months. She was familiar with the claims that had been asserted in state court.
She had reviewed all the depositions.
No, but there are many uses to depositions besides just admissibility at trial in federal court.
Well, isn't all that a question of fact?
In this case, I think it was abundantly obvious that all of the state court depositions could be used in federal court.
Do you have case law to suggest that a court can rule on a motion to dismiss without holding a hearing on attorney fees? according to the AWDI case, there ought to be a hearing on that for the court
to
impose.
Your Honor, I think, in fairness, what the cases are saying is the court makes an initial determination as to whether or not the defendants have met their burden such that they would be entitled to attorney's fees. And if the court makes that determination that there should be an entitlement to fees, then I think it's possible to have a subsequent hearing at which you go through the itemization.
Isn't there many cases throughout the country that say it's standard course to award attorney fees as a term and condition in granting a motion to dismiss?
No, Your Honor, I believe in all fairness, what the cases say is that there is no entitlement to attorney's fees for work product that will remain useful in federal court.
I don't think anybody's disputing that.
The AWDI case very clearly says that in this context, a Rule 41A2 motion, the burden of proof is on the defendants to show that they have an entitlement to attorney's fees.
And they need to satisfy that burden of proof through pleadings before a hearing?
Yes, I believe that in the response, they have to present their argument to the court and any evidence that they want to submit. It's their burden to show the judge that under these circumstances, we should have an entitlement to attorney's fees.
All right, well, let's take that then. In terms of experts, which may be a little more concrete than the depositions, they say the parties will need to resubmit expert reports that address the issues of the civil rights and RICO claims and then redepose expert witnesses, end quote. Now, there were no civil rights and RICO claims in the state case, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Why isn't what I just read to you sufficient to require the trial court then to have a hearing and allow the defendants the opportunity to prove that, you know, some, all, or maybe none of the expert reports are useful in the federal action?
I think that the line that you just read, all that is saying, and all that similar statements would say, is when you take the smaller state court case over to federal court, there are broader issues in the federal court case. And there will be new work that has to be done to address the new issues. But that's a different inquiry. We're talking about the work that was done in state court, which still applies in federal court. In other words, all of the expert reports that addressed the BBB's conduct in 2003, all of the expert reports that addressed General Steele, all of that is still going to be used in federal court. In fact, as we recited in our briefs, there was a scheduling conference in federal court where it was all very clearly acknowledged that this body of work that had been done in state court would move over to federal court. The parties weren't going to touch subject matters and timeframes that were done in state court. And that's an acknowledgement that all of that work would still be useful over in federal court.
Let me perhaps use a better example, which was suggested by your opponent. What about lawyer time that was spent on purely procedural state court issues, you know, scheduling conferences, non-substantive orders? It seems to me that work has no utility in federal court.
I would disagree on a couple of counts. First of all, that's not an argument that they presented to the trial court in their briefs, but even if they had, there are essentially two major products of discovery that occurred in state court that will move over to federal court. It's the document production, and nobody disputes that will be used.
But excuse me, I'm asking you a little different question.
No, I understand.
I'm not talking about the discovery or the documents or the experts. I mean, can you say with a straight face that there's not 1 hour of lawyer time invested in the state case that will now be useless in the federal case?
I'm not suggesting that. I mean, clearly, if you poke around the extreme edges of the state court case, you could find some time that maybe as a technical matter isn't tangibly, visibly being used. But everything that you do in case management order is building the process of getting to the point of obtaining your documents and doing your depositions. That whole process, which led to getting the product in state court, That's all useful. That when you negotiate a case management order, when you submit a document request, that's what you have to go through to get the documents and to get the depositions. And none of that has to be redone. All of that was done in state court.
Would you agree that that's a question of fact under the case law, under AWDI, that that's purely a question of fact?
Well, it may be a question of fact, but I believe it's an issue that the defendants bore the burden to present in their response brief. They should have told the court. As Your Honor said at the outset, they submitted a one-line all-or-nothing request. If that's the argument they are now making on this appeal, then that's the argument they should have made at the trial court. They should have said, yes, all of the documents and all of the experts and all of the fact witness depositions can be used, but, you know, we'd really like the court to consider that back on January 13th, 2004, the party sat down and we negotiated a case management order, and we think that time ought to be reimbursed. They didn't make that argument in their response brief. So the trial court was presented with what she was presented with, and that's what she ruled on. And I guess just returning to the point I was starting to make, there seems to be this emphasis on use equating with admissibility at trial. Obviously, all of this work that led up to getting all of these documents and getting these depositions are all being used left and right in federal court. They give parties information about the cases. They will be used to prepare direct examinations. They will be used to prepare cross-examinations. The standard is use in continuing litigation. The standard is not that it will be admissible at trial.
Were any of the depositions taken solely to perpetuate the testimony of an out-of-state witness, as opposed to discovery?
Again, this is not an issue that was presented to the trial court, and in my view, all of the depositions that occurred were discovery depositions. In other words, no one noticed up a deposition as a trial preservation deposition.
That was my question.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, I mean, it is clear that all of this work is being used in federal court. It's useful in the same way as if the parties had simply amended their complaint in state court and continued to move forward. But obviously everyone was past the deadlines in state court, so you couldn't do it. And I just did want to point out that in the AWDI case, it very clearly says that, and I quote, the party requesting an award of attorney's fees, which was clearly the defendants, bears the burden of proving by a preponderance of the evidence its entitlement to such an award. And so that's why I say it was their burden in their brief to come forward and convince this court that it had an entitlement to the award that they were asking for.
Didn't in AWDI they had a multi-day hearing on that question, didn't they?
I believe once the court determined that there was an entitlement to the award, then
right, the court couldn't determine that award amount without a hearing.
Right, at a subsequent hearing. But in this case, there was no request for that kind of a procedure. Again, the trial court could only respond to what she was actually presented with. And as the court has observed, there was about a half paragraph section in their response brief in which literally all they said was that all of the 32 depositions would essentially be meaningless. Well, that's just an inaccurate statement of fact for the reasons I said. Those depositions have a lot of use for a lot of reasons, even if they're not admitted to trial, which they likely will be. And so I believe it was very appropriate for the trial court, in exercising her discretion, when she was faced with that one sentence, to say, that doesn't make any sense. I don't see anything here that convinces me that there is an entitlement to an award. And there was no request for any kind of further specific procedures. And I would also point out that the court or the defendants did not even submit any case law addressing these Rule 41 standards in their brief. We presented those standards in our brief, and those are the standards that appear in the court's order, and they're laid out in great detail. Uh, I'll address very briefly, since my time is short, the just two quick items. So we've laid out in great detail what these defendants told the federal court at the scheduling conference. It's very clear that everyone is intending to use all of the state court work product in federal court. And that applies to dispositive motions. If they are going to refile motions that they lost, in which in some cases they've already done that, they can take that state court work product. They literally have just put a new caption on it, and they can use that work product to submit new motions in federal court. By the same token, as to motions that they won, they're getting the benefit of both the work product that went into achieving that ruling, and they're getting the benefit of the ruling itself. As to the claims we haven't brought in federal court, that's another indication of them getting the benefit of the work product in state court. If they achieved a dismissal of a claim and we didn't submit the claim, and I'm out of time. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honors. Just a few quick points, as I have no choice. The AWDI case, as Your Honor pointed out, does state as follows. No matter how conscientious and diligent the plaintiff may have been, defendant suffered some cost by defending this action, and the defendant is entitled to such reimbursement of those costs as the court may order. It also says that while a motion to dismiss voluntarily should generally be granted, the court must first determine that any harm to the defendant may be avoided by imposing terms and conditions of dismissal. With respect to the claim that we didn't make any notice to the court below of procedural matters, page 8018 states that the case has endured protracted motion practice, and all of this will be meaningless in the federal court action. Lastly, General Steel concedes at page 38 of its footnote 26 of its reply brief that two non-party out-of-state witnesses were deposed and claims that the work devoted thereto would be de minimis. It clearly is not, and we're entitled on remand to have a full evidentiary hearing to establish the full amount of the fees we incurred, our clients incurred in defending this action that are not useful in the federal court action. Thank you, Your Honors.
We appreciate the arguments of both counsel. The case stands submitted. A written opinion will issue in due course. Counsel are excused, and once the tables have cleared and the blow-up is taken down, counsel in our last case, parental responsibilities of MJJ, may set up.